Hello and welcome to Didion Hawthorne in the In-Between, or DH&I. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to our podcast about the relevance of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. Hello, hello, and welcome to our spooktastic programming for the month of October. That's right, Horrifying Classics 2020. Today's horrifying classic is the 1933 hit The Werewolf of Paris by Guy Endor, which is an American Gothic novel set largely in Paris in the 1870s. While the novel is a bit dated in terms of the style and language in which it is written, its themes are certainly not dated, as the novel's main themes are sexuality and the erosion of capitalism, to encompass several smaller themes into two big ones, that is. And this themes versus style dichotomy quite reminds me of Hemingway's The Garden of Eden, which we did last month on the show and which is, of course, linked in the description. In fact, you can find all of our sources today at relevanceofliterature.com/notes or at the link directly in the description box for this episode. The edition. Believe it or not, I got this edition for free off of Amazon. The publisher, or more accurately, the distributor in this case, is Pegasus Books. This book was actually out of print for almost 40 years before it was brought back within the last 10 years or so for a bit of a revival. It was hugely popular when it came out in 1933 because it dealt with a lot of the themes that especially young people were interested in at that time. It's also the seminal werewolf book, much like Dracula is for the vampire or Frankenstein is for Frankenstein. Though interestingly, it's not really connected with any film adaptations per se, which is usually an indicator of this kind of thing. Some pluses from the edition that I used are that, of course, it's free and that downloading it is pretty much a breeze. You can just download it on your Kindle from Amazon or the Kindle store. Minuses, though, are that the page numbers and text scripts are not super adjustable or accessible, especially for technology-deficient people like me. Another minus is that there's a lot of typos in this edition. That is just unfortunately a trait of a lot of the free literature that is out there, and that can get pretty annoying when you're reading, especially for people like me who notice typos every time. One particularly glaring typo that was in the edition, just because of the formatting it's in, is that when there are two vowels in a row, it adds an umlaut on the second vowel. Of course, in English, we don't have umlauts, but as a bilingual English-German speaker, it was pretty annoying to have that weird brain switch in the middle of reading an English text. The frame. While we will be spending a portion of the show on Halloween looking over definitions for and tropes of Gothic literature, it's impossible to get by a review of this novel without mention of its rather unusual frame. Frames, of course, being a staple of Gothic horror. A frame narrative serves as an outer layer to a novel. Generally, frames only get alluded to at the beginning of a work and occasionally at the end of a work. Frankenstein has a well-known frame, so does The Turn of the Screw, both of which have been horrifying classics at some point and are linked down below. In this case, however, the frame is rather unusual because the narrator decides to interject in bits and bobs throughout the narrative, interrupting the progress of the inner narrative to make comments, excuses, and to address the reader. Plot. Our outer frame in the novel to start is when the narrator introduces us to a friend of his called Eliana. Eliana is an American who visits our narrator in Paris and is having a rowdy time. Of course, the frame narration, the outer frame, is set a little bit later than the 1870s, my guess is, around the 1920s or later. And Eliana is having a rowdy time only to become suddenly promiscuous at the end of the night and leave with a stranger. The narrator, walking home and pondering the wolf, or lupus in Latin, runs into a group of men who are sorting trash and treasures in a park, and he comes across this interesting manuscript. So he buys the manuscript, of course, and upon reading it, begins to recount its contents to us, the readers, which serve as our inner frame. Throughout, as I mentioned previously, the narrator from the outer frame does frequently interject in order to provide some more context or just organize the manuscript a bit better. So throughout this summary of the plot, just imagine our narrator popping in throughout. We start in this narrative with, I thought, a really interesting but jarring change, which is that we're in super long ago, I don't know what century it is, probably the 13th or the 12th century, and there's these two warring families. The one that's important to us is the Piedmonts, and the Piedmonts, one of them, one of their ranks, probably one of the sons of the main leaders, comes into the opposing family. Just think about like Montague Capulets kind of feud here. Two rich families and a feud. One of the sons of the Piedmont clan goes into the other family's home disguised as a monk, and in the night murders the head of the household as well as his wife. But unfortunately, he stumbles in the chamber, in the corridor, as he is going to murder everyone else in the household, and he's found out as a Piedmont, and he's imprisoned within this well. That's an old well in the back courtyard, and they sort of build like this, almost, this is where it goes into fantasy, like historical fantasy of some kind, where there's a glass dome over the well. There's a question of how did they build a dome in, you know, the 12th century. That's at least one of my questions. And they stick him down in there. There's a grate that he's able to get food from, and there's constant water as well. And this member, this person who's imprisoned, decides, I am never going to speak, never ever, until I'm liberated. And he is in this prison for 50 odd years, 50 plus years, and throughout that time he turns into something less than human. They start out giving him cooked meat, and then start giving him raw meat. And if his meat is ever late, which is frequently late because they like to taunt him, he starts howling and giving these inhuman, awful impressions of a wolf. Now let's fast forward here to around the 1850s, early 1860s. Our narrator of the inner frame, which is Aymar Gallier. Aymar is a revolutionary, so he starts out in his own narrative. This is what our outer frame narrator is reading from. So Gallier starts out from his narrative as an impartial observer. He's invested in being a revolutionary. We know that he limps because he was wounded in some of the protests and revolutions and things that were happening in 1848 in Paris. And he is living with his aunt at that time, who is very wealthy and who supports his endeavors. So the aunt is sponsoring this young orphan from her home village named Josephine. She's just 14 at this time. She comes to live with them in Paris, and there's one day where there's a really bad lightning storm, and the aunt says, you know what, Josephine, go to the church. It's really easy to find. You can see it. I need some holy water so that I can protect myself from this really bad storm. Josephine goes in there, and there is a priest named Father Piedmont who rapes her, and she ends up getting pregnant by him. And it's, yeah, this is the start to the downturn in this narrative. So in order to essentially protect her name, the aunt sends Josephine away to have her baby for the time being, and Aymar, in that interim, gets involved with Josephine sexually, and even though he knows that it's wrong, and he knows that there's something really terrible going on here, and there's sort of a spell, it's sort of a wicked thing going on, there's this theme of failed restraint, which I think is very poignantly first demonstrated through Aymar as he is grappling with himself and his own monstrous parts. But now I want to get into the baby, which they name Bertrand, and the signs that he is a werewolf. I think this is probably interesting to the people who want to know what a werewolf is by Guy Endor's estimation. So one sign is that the werewolf was conceived by a false priest, which was Piedmont, of course. Piedmont should not have done that. It was terrible and it should be condemned, absolutely. Piedmont is also of the family of Piedmont, which is, you know, we start out the story with a recollection of the origins of Piedmont's family, which of course alludes that perhaps this guy was predisposed in some ways to be horrible like this. And werewolfism and having a sexual drive are very, very interconnected in this. And so the next trait here, after conceived by a false priest, is that the mother suddenly has an insatiable sexual drive. Unfortunately, Josephine becomes very promiscuous after the rape, and she has laid with everyone in town, says the cook. And she is just, yeah, and this is something that pulls Imar in as well as he sees this. And he's going, what is going on? And he's sort of drawn by it. So there's a lot of infidelity and things of that nature associated, of course, with this insatiable sexual drive coming from Josephine. People in the village are catching on. People in Paris, I mean, are catching on. Born on Christmas is the next trait. Of course, Bertrand is born on Christmas. It means that he was conceived during a period in the Christian calendar when people are not allowed to engage in sexual relations, so it's just the ultimate bad thing that he was born on Christmas. It was sort of a slap in the face to Christianity, especially with this false priest aspect. When Bertrand is a baby, he also has a unibrow, which was thought to be some sort of superstition for witchcraft. He also, as a baby, howls when death is near. So when the aunt is on her deathbed and no one but the baby necessarily knows or can pick up on that, he howls like a wolf when the aunt is dying. He also has hairy palms. And I think this is such a weird one because I didn't really understand this trait or come across it in my life before reading Dracula, our book for next week, and Dracula also has hairy palms, and apparently people were very suspicious of others with hairy palms, so look out for those hairy palms. I'm kidding, of course. The last trait here is really like two instances combined in one, which is he's wounded by silver bullets and by closeness with religion. And so Imar, on request of his dying aunt, becomes a priest. He doesn't necessarily become a practicing priest, but he does take his examinations, and he believes, personally at least, that that is one of the main reasons he was never harmed by Bertrand when Bertrand was living with him, is because he was endowed with the Holy Spirit and he was able to have protection from him. So where we pick up in the narrative next is years after Bertrand is born, about 10 years later, when the aunt is of course dead. M. Gallier, or Imar Gallier, and his company, so the cook and Josephine and Bertrand, are all living in the country, basically on the aunt's money. Bertrand, who we later know in his older adult life as Bertrand Callier, is growing and he's turning into a wolf at night. So there's this whole debacle in the village where there are these sheep that get mangled and livestock and things of that nature are going missing, and there's this big wolf that has been spotted. So the town constable of sorts is tasked with taking down the wolf. And he ends up, you know, after several months of just sleepless nights, staying up for the wolf, he does eventually shoot the wolf with a silver bullet. and the bullet gets lodged in Bertrand's leg and is later found by Aymar, who realizes he sort of digs up all the suspicions from Bertrand's birth, and he says, oh my gosh, Bertrand is a werewolf, so he keeps the bullet among other manuscripts and things. Eventually he discards them, but he keeps them and he realizes, yeah, Bertrand is a werewolf, and he's the one responsible for all of the livestock damages. So Aymar never does, I should mention this because it's quite an interesting fact, for me at least, he never sees the wolf himself, so he never sees Bertrand change, but he often hears the wolf when he locks Bertrand up or sees other signs in Bertrand, like the signs that we were talking about earlier. And finally, Bertrand is a young man, and he takes this disastrous trip to Paris to essentially study medicine. And there's an incident that occurs, of course, where he is involved with a prostitute because he gets peer pressured into going, and that young prostitute gets chomped at the end of the day. He bites her, gets the taste for human blood, and it's all over. She doesn't die, but she's severely injured. The solution, when Bertrand gets home and hears of this business with the prostitute who gets chomped, is for Aymar to lock Bertrand in his room and as well feed him raw meat. And this is essentially what Aymar thinks will tame the wolf inside of him and allow the wolf not to come out and need to harm people, harm animals, etc. Fun story though, Bertrand ends up escaping and he ends up chomping a lot of people. He exhumes graves as he did in his hometown in the country, and he ends up joining the National Guard to make a meager income. He does go through a period of heavy loathing and just, you know, what is my place in this world kind of pain, because he doesn't really realize that he's a werewolf until he leaves for Paris and wakes up and there's severed arms next to him, etc. And he was so taken with this idea that his dreams, which is when, well, at night when he's a werewolf, he wakes up in the morning as a human and thinks that he's been dreaming the whole time. And so this becomes a huge problem because he thinks that, oh, it's excusable because it happened in a dream, when in reality he's doing some serious damage in the real world. So he goes through this process of self-loathing, and eventually at this canteen he falls in love with a girl named Sophie, who is a very wealthy young woman. She comes from a very wealthy young family, or a very wealthy family. She is young, but the family is not. And they end up, long story short, she ditches the guy who she's betrothed to and who really loves her. She ditches him because she finds him boring and too classic. And then she gets with Bertrand and starts exploring her sexuality and includes a lot of things about sexuality and violence, for example, which is very, very extreme for a book coming from this time period. And essentially Bertrand here gets free blood. He like cuts her up and sucks out the blood. Not enough to kill her, just enough to maim her essentially, and she gets her weird sexual drive over with. So it's a very odd relationship and very extreme for this time period. The ending of the novel is very, very chaotic, if I can use that word in a professional manner. Bertrand, essentially, this is all, of course, during the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, so there's a war going on. That's why Bertrand is able to join the National Guard and get an income, because every young man in France was in the National Guard at that time. Bertrand gets arrested because he takes a midnight chomp on someone and he ends up injuring him and gets caught, and he gets committed to an insane asylum, and he is treated terribly in that asylum. He eventually escapes the whole ordeal of continuing living a terrible life in that asylum through his death. Sophie, yearns, essentially, after she loses him, to go crazy. She has this very odd relationship with death that she's able to escape through the violence that she explores with Bertrand. So having this vehicle taken away from her ends up being very detrimental to her, that is. So essentially, she goes crazy and puts everything that she has towards fighting in the battalion that Bertrand used to be a part of. She helps destroy Paris, which, interestingly, and this historically matches the time period, because there was a siege of women during this time period, as I said, in Paris, and this definitely was happening a little earlier and proceeded later in Paris, where the women were taking an active part in the destruction and the protesting. So Sophie essentially puts everything in her being towards that, and she pretty much does go crazy at the end. She should have been more careful with what she wished for in that regard, for sure. And she eventually dies. This theme of escape through death, escape of life's horrors, that is, through death, is certainly not a new one. It's one that is explored over and over again in Greek tragedy. Was a huge proponent of German literature and German music in the 18 and 1900s. So there is a lot going on here that this book is adapting in terms of it, not only the time period and the history, but the literature motifs and themes. Except for the themes of sexuality, the themes of capitalism that we mentioned earlier, of course. And in terms of Imar, there's not really a resolution for Imar, at least not in my opinion. He maybe has a little more room to breathe. He ends up writing this narrative, of course, after all of these events have taken place. He gets arrested a couple times, but I felt like he didn't give himself justice in his own narrative. And I was a little bit frustrated with that, to be honest. Connections to the modern day. So one of the most glaring connections and applications of this novel is that the people of Paris and that area generally were so caught up in the ways of the world, and this is the capitalism bit, that they were able to somehow miss these important obvious things, namely several bloody murders and exhumations in the Paris area, that would have been important to note otherwise. And so this, like, werewolf ravaging Paris symbol is really a symbol of people being too caught up in war and capitalism and politics to notice real important tangible issues, not only within their own lives, but within their immediate areas. Another question that I might pose is, what is the relationship between insanity or bad or unusual decisions? Related to that, can Bertrand be blamed for his nature and his deeds? And my response to this latter question is, yes, I think he should be responsible for his actions. Ultimately, they are his actions, no matter where those actions come from. And it seems like Bertrand really does have some freedom of choice. He chooses to get involved with this bad relationship with Sophie. He chooses to allow himself to go out and exhume graves, for example, at least for a while. So I do believe that he should be responsible for the second question, but it's up to you, commenters. What do you think? And finally, to wrap this episode up, how many werewolves really are out there? And this question comes from the climax of the novel, the climax of Aymar Gallier's narrative, when he realizes that there are hundreds and thousands of bloodthirsty young men out there during the war, and are they really worse than Bertrand in general? That is a big question of the novel, and the question of war and how all of that pans out. That is it for the episode and the content today. As always, leave comments, questions, everything in the comments box down below, and we'll see you on Halloween. I don't know about you, but I am a sucker for unboxing videos. I'm a minimalist, okay, but I like it when other people unbox stuff because everyone benefits. I get to see a cool new wow product without having to collect more stuff, by the way, and they get to keep that stuff for themselves or give it away, whatever. Win-win. But recently, I have been trying my hand at my own bookish unboxing videos because, let's face it, I buy and read a lot of books. If y'all want to get your foot in the door and have access to my unboxing videos and also some upcoming giveaways, because I'm still a minimalist, please help me out here. Join our Patreon at patreon.com/relevanceofliterature.